I'd like to present to you now War Churchill.
Thanks for coming.
CEO, proceed you. Hello, my relatives. My name, the one bestowed and recognized by the colonizer, is Ward Churchill. My name is Kanis Arkijanabe. I am of the Ketua Band Cherokee, and by marriage, both our peoples being matrilineal, of the Piju or Lynx Can, Ojibwe of Onigami, hence my Ojibwe names. And it is an honor to be here again on Abenaki land. The Abenaki are what's called an untreated people, meaning they never signed a treaty with the federal government of the United States, and by virtue of never signing a treaty with the federal government of the United States, never ceded one square inch of their traditional territory. This is illegally occupied land. Illegally occupied not by the Abenaki, whose land it is, but by the federal government of the United States. Welcome to occupied America. You're living in it. That doesn't register in a day-to-day consciousness, and it should. It should. One of the criticisms that was advanced in a newspaper today, sort of thing that was being referred to, leads perhaps in a spirit of equity and fairness, or at least attempting to create that impression, with a description of me as being a foremost expert on the plight of American Indians. So that's substantial stuff. Now, I might quibble with the foremost description, but let's just assume for a moment it's true. I'm described in your local paper as a foremost expert on indigenous issues. And, of course, it goes on to say, none of you are going to know who I am, because that's what I'm an expert in. The most fundamental set of issues on this continent, the question of the disposition of the land upon which this country is constructed, is so irrelevant that someone expert in those issues would be unknown to the general public. And then it goes on to quibble about my disrespect with respect to an event that occurred in September that's of consequence to the dominant population. And my point that they were taking exception to was genocide is perpetrated not out of sight, out of mind, but in the face of the ignorance of that very same public. Ignorance is not something I mean to have used as a synonym for being uninformed. Uninformed is not to have information. To be ignorant is to have the information and ignore it. That plays in to the construction of 9/11. But before I get all off into why, in part, that's true, in a way I haven't done yet today, I'd like to call for another round of applause for the people who have come before. See, I had a sort of a learning experience tonight. The last singer, Jim Page, I once described as being a mad neurosurgeon bent upon the mission of performing a mind transplant on the body politic of America. Yeah. I found absolutely nothing tonight to make me change that view, except I find that tonight we had a whole surgical team. It's been an incredible set of performances that have occurred tonight. And a communication, that mind transplant, even to people who thought they understood the issues, the understanding has been enriched and deepened as a result of what it was that was addressed and how it was addressed. And I don't address things that way. I'm feeling like kind of the odd man out standing up here because I'm not a poet and I'm not a singer. So it's a different kind of presentation. The way I go at things is very different. Maybe that's good. Maybe it's a misfit. I don't know. But we're just stuck with what we got, and we do the best with what we've got, and that's what I'm setting out to do right now. And we toss some words around today. All of us who have spoken, and all of us who have spoken about what was spoken. And I don't want to repeat what it was that was said. I don't want to go back into the argument on chickens coming home to roost and so forth, but you really can't avoid it. And I don't want to repeat the three worlds argument and the nature of the fourth and the internal colonial construction and all of that that happened at the university tonight, although that's clearly relevant as well. But I want to take off perhaps from the word that has linked each of the presentations, particularly it occurs to me, in the lyric of the song, the word genocide was used. And genocide was used in the rally presentations earlier today. And genocide was used in the Sartrean equation of colonialism and genocide in the presentations at the university. There's that G word. That G word. We all use it. It gets used in the discourse. It's almost flip. Genocide has been perpetrated. But what does that mean? And there are probably people in the room who actually know, in a genuine sense, in a definitional sense, what the word means, but it tends not to be that way. Even among people who are progressive and enlightened and use the word well-intentionedly and in part correctly, there's still a fundamental, not so much misunderstanding in this country as there is a disunderstanding of what it's about, because it gets used as a synonym for mass murder. And mass murder can be a part of genocide. Clearly, it can be a part of genocide. And to that extent, we've been addressing it all day long, but that's not the actuality of the term. It certainly doesn't encompass the meaning of it. So when we use that word, particularly when we use it here, and I'm going to illustrate everything that has to do with the black letter legal definition of genocide in terms of things that are current events in this country as pertain to Native people. It's not simply exclusively pertinent to Native people. But I've been talking about Iraqis, as I should. I've been talking about Palestinians, as I should. I've been talking about other peoples all day long with only side references to my own, and I'm going to focus on my own, if you'll excuse me that self-indulgence here tonight. Because, as I said, the situation of Native people in this country is the most fundamental issue there is. Absent resolution of indigenous issues in America, there can be no solution to the overall set of problems that I think everyone here is committed to addressing. But genocide, what does the word actually mean, and is it appropriate when we talk about the genocide of indigenous people here, now? Current events, not as an historical fact, although a historical fact also exists. Let's go to the definition of the word as it was originally coined. And I say disinformation or disunderstanding is pertinent to the public consciousness of the term because it's not a very old word. It hasn't had time to mutate in consciousness and discourse in and of itself. It's been required that there be a concerted effort to cause people to disunderstand it. It was coined originally in 1944 by exiled Polish Jewish jurist by the name of Raphael Lemkin, who was trying to do an overall assessment of the implications of Nazi occupation policy in the Second World War. Book, if anybody wants to check out what it is I'm going to say, in which the definition is coined, the word itself is coined, is titled Axis Rule in Occupied Europe. You can go over to the UVermont Library and check it out. Probably nobody's looked at it in the last 30 years, law faculty included. Okay, so you can get an almost virgin read out of the thing because it's barely been cracked. Spine's intact. 1944 edition. That would be the only edition you'll find. It's not been reprinted since. Just turn to page 79. Okay? You don't have to try to wade through it all. Page 79 is the opening page of a chapter titled Genocide, in which he makes the coinage, and he offers the definition. Now, first of all, you have to understand in 1944, if what he was going to talk about was mass murder per se, it would have been no need to conjure up a new word to describe it. Mass murder was something that was well understood in human affairs and in law. It was codified. It was sanctioned. Penalties were attached to it. Mass murder is mass murder. He comes up with the word genocide, so you got a distinction right then and there. The definition that he puts forth is distinct from murder as follows. Genocide is any policy undertaken with intent to bring about the dissolution or disappearance of an identified and targeted human group as such. Note, dissolution and disappearance. Dissolution and death are completely separate things. Disappearance can imply death. That's the first thing you need to note. The second thing is group, not individuals. When you take dissolution and group and put them together, you can see right off, as is made clear in the remainder of the book and has been made clear by analysts since, a genocide can occur even if every individual within the identified and targeted group remains alive in the aftermath. If the group itself is pushed out of existence, no longer exists, a genocide has occurred, you don't have to kill a single person in the process of committing the crime of genocide, which registers on the scale of international crime at the very, very top of the heap. This is the most serious offense that can be committed by one group of human beings vis-a-vis another, and it does not require killing. Of course, it can, and usually does, include killing, whether direct or indirect. Okay? But to punctuate the point on the absence of necessity or killing in a direct sense or even an indirect sense to be involved, consider, he classifies killing as a mode of genocide. If you kill all the members of the targeted group, it is going to disappear. This is clear. We shouldn't have questions about that. This he defines as physical genocide. He's got a second classification, then he has a third. Second classification is what he calls biological genocide. Now consider it. By biological genocide, he means prevention of births within the group, usually by way of sterilization. The idea of compulsory abortion hadn't occurred to anybody. That could be included under that rubric now, but he's talking primarily about sterilization. Now consider that. You take the targeted group, you say, intern them in camps as the Nazis did. You do not kill them. You simply sterilize them as the Nazis were doing to the gypsies. You have killed no one at the end of the process, and yet at the end of the single generation, they will go biologically, physically out of existence just as surely as if you'd sat them up against the wall and shot them all. It is not necessary to kill to perpetrate genocide. And the third classification is cultural genocide, and that's the one the United States has a problem with, because as he points out, historical rendering of the subject, crime, he says, is ancient, although the term is modern. Cultural genocide is by far the most frequent form undertaken. If you destroy a people's ability to sustain itself cohesively in existence in terms that it understands itself to be a people, if you undertake policies that prevent that from happening so that the people itself cannot hang together as such, it's a genocidal policy. Now, what you find coming out of a draft of the Genocide Convention that he prepares for the United Nations, he's the person that is enlisted to draft a legal instrument codifying the crime of genocide. This is later revised on the basis of his draft into what has now become the 1948 Convention on Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. You can see the echoes of what he's saying in a 1944 text in the black letter legal formulation of the crime. Second article is the one that is most germane. Second article defines genocide as any policy undertaken with intent to destroy in whole or in part, and catch the in part part. It's not got to be absolute. You just got to set about it. You got to attempt it. That triggers the understanding that the crime has been committed. Even if you don't manage to complete the process, it's still a crime of genocide. So the in part is important. Any policy undertaken with intent to destroy in whole or in part an ethnical, racial, national, or religious group as such. And there are five criteria enumerated under it, which define the broad categories of policy at issue. The first has to do with killing of the members of the group. That's the most straightforward and probably considered the most consequential and least reversible, and therefore there's a certain order of priority, although it's not entirely clear to me that that's true. Killing is first. Killing we've been talking about all day. Killing we were talking about with the Iraqi children. Killing we were talking about with the firebombings in Japan. Killing we were talking about with the Filipinos. Killing we've been talking about in depth. We could talk about it more. With regard to Indians in an historical sense, in terms of direct killing, I'm going to say two words and eliminate the arguments that there was never an intentional policy to eradicate Indians as a target group within the context of the United States. And those two words are scalp bounties. Scalp bounties, as was discussed at the university today, were paid. I think Don Grindy brought it up and laid it out fairly well. Scalp bounties were the payment of a fee for proof of death of an Indian, any Indian, on a graduated scale. At the top of the scale, they would pay the highest amount for proof of death by way of the production of a scalp or bloody red skin, origin of the term red skins, of an adult male Indian. Half that fee would be paid for proof of death by the same means of adult female. Quarter to be paid for proof of death of a child being defined as a human being under 10 years of age, down to and including the fetus. So the sorts of things John Ross were talking about going on in Chiapas very recently are things that have antecedents here and a long trajectory, because every single colony on the East Coast, every state of the Union and territory of the United States within the confines of the 48 contiguous states had in place for some period in its history a scalp bounty removed, usually when there were no longer sufficient number of Indians left to kill to warrant its continuation. That's as absolutely clinical a genocidal policy as is possible to envision. They weren't interested in any particular Indians. Any Indians would do, and they would pay for the proof of death. They wanted all of us dead. That's an historical fact. Perhaps we can leave it as an historical fact, but it's an unatoned and usually unacknowledged historical fact. And that goes to that term that was being used by John in the title of the book about oblivion. It has to do with historical consciousness. It has to do with social memory. It has to do with understanding the nature of the relationships as they've evolved between people, and a denial of the reality of that sort is to maintain a situation among the aggrieved, the victim group, the wounded, to where the wound cannot heal, ever heal, absent acknowledgement on the part of the perpetrator population. And since the perpetrator population per se has died out, let's say the descendants and beneficiaries of the perpetration of such criminal policy. Yes? Against oblivion. Remember it. In the process of the remembrance, understand it for what it means. And in the process of understanding what it means, adjust relations with people. And that's all I'll say on killing, because it's not the most current in a direct sense. There's four more. Now, those who would conflate murder and genocide understand killing is one of five criteria. That makes it 20% of the overall definition. 80% has to do with things which are non-lethal in form. Second has to do, and it's about as far from killing as you can get, with the imposition of policies engendering serious psychological, physical harm among members of the target group. The idea being making them so uncomfortable in some fashion or another that they will wish to, quote, voluntarily disassociate themselves from the group targeted. And if a sufficient number of people try to step out of a group, the group's going to begin to lose its cohesion, dissolve, and ultimately disappear. How could that possibly have bearing on a situation of indigenous people in the United States now? Anybody ever watch a John Ford Western? Anybody ever seen Stalking Moon? Anybody ever go down for a big screen viewing of Lawrence of South Dakota? I mean, Dances with Wolves? Yeah. Those are some titles drawn from the 2,000-odd Hollywood feature films, all following the same themes of depiction and degradation and demeaning of Native people. And those 2,000 Hollywood films are coupled to 10,000 television segments, which have been released over the years, with which we are consistently bombarded from birth till death in this country. Native children right along with other children. And while it may be just kind of fun to the general population, try to imagine the self-concept formation for a Native child, a sense of self-esteem or lack of same that's inculcated by seeing F Troop. And stepping away from the TV to open a newspaper and being confronted with Tumbleweed's cartoon. And trying to watch sports on Saturday afternoon, turning on and seeing the number one in the nation, Florida State Seminoles, with those fools in the stands with their turkey feather headdresses and their grease paint doing the tomahawk chop and the Indian chant while the Indians are locked out of the stadium protesting. Want to do it in professional sports instead? Try the Washington Redskins. Remember what Redskins means. The general population may not know that, but a lot of our children do, and look what it is that's being celebrated there. It's just clean fun, you say, on the way to the Jeep Cherokee or the Winnebago camper, on your way to ski at Squaw Peak. Squaw Peak. You know, it's just above Squaw Valley, through which runs Squaw Creek. Quick test for the audience. Does anyone here know what squaw means? I know you do. I told you. Say? Yeah, it's kind of a derogatory word for a woman, but it has a more specific meaning. So the derogation has a particular form. It's not the Algonquian contraction of sung squaw. It's a Mohawk word corrupted. The Mohawk word translated in English is actually, it's two words. I won't say what the slang would be. But it's a Mohawk word for female genitalia, converted into hip slang and slung about in 4,000 place names and in movies and on TV and in classrooms. And when, again, often the people using the term from the dominant society don't know what it actually means, it's, they think, just sort of like making reference to a chick, our children often do. Our women certainly do. Our elder women who get squaws understand. And when the children complain in school, they're quite often disciplined for being thin-skinned because nobody really meant anything about it. Well, call the teacher the English equivalent in an English-only context of what that slang word would actually be and see, actually, how come see, come saw this actually is. Yeah? It's a non-issue. You need to know about it. Well, try running that English equivalent across the head of women's studies up at UVT and see where you get with that aside from banned from campus, except our children and our women are supposed to put it up with it because there's no harm intended. Take that four-letter C word and start applying it to mountains and counties and roads and creeks and see where you get. Yeah, yeah. That goes to the psychological harm that's damaging, that's deforming to self-concept, that is destructive to self-esteem, with consequences that I will put in statistical terms. We have a suicide rate among adolescent American Indian people that is about 1,000% the GPOP rate. We have 70%. By official estimate, 70% of all adolescent and younger Aboriginal children in northern Manitoba addicted to gasoline. Gasoline, solvents, equivalent substances, which they've been informed will not only make you high, take away your consciousness of your situation for a short term, but run every probability of brain damage that's permanent, that you will be permanently blotting out your consciousness, and they are intentionally and instructedly, self-interestedly trying to destroy their ability to perceive the reality in which they're engulfed on a permanent basis. And you have to ask yourself why a 9-year-old child would do that. And not just one, but 7 out of every 10. Psychological harm, genocidal effect, clearly equate right there. I can give you other examples, but that should make the case. Now, physically harming individuals. Let's just start here. On paper, nominally, despite all of the expropriation of property and all of the horror that's ensued over the centuries, American Indian people remain the largest per capita landholders on the continent. 50 million acres in the U.S. aggregate of reservation land, 2 million Indians. Divide the 50 million by the 2 million, you get 25 acres per Indian. There's not another population group in North America can say that person for person, they're holding 25 acres of land. So we're land rich. Of course, it's land that was thought to be of no value at all by the dominant society at the time it was assigned to Indians. It was the dumping grounds where we were supposed to die off, out of sight, out of mind, to the polite society. Turns out one of these great historical ironies to be some of the most mineral-rich terrain on the planet. Two-thirds of what the United States claims as its domestic uranium reserves, a quarter of the low-sulfur coal, at least the readily accessible stuff, a fifth of the oil and natural gas, bauxite, copper, iron ore, industrial-grade diamonds, zeolites. People haven't even heard of zeolites. I'll explain that to anybody if they're interested afterwards. It's a very valuable mineral. All of that on the estimated grade of the ore and the quantity of that grade of ore can be converted into dollar equivalency. That's how the dominant society assigns value. And I don't know what the total value of those estimated quantities of resources would come to. You just take this long column of very large figures and you add it up, and whatever the bottom line is, and there's a lot of zeros going to be in it, you divide that by the 2 million Indians and you got the richest population group in North America by far on a per capita basis. Doesn't mean every Indian running around in North America ought to be the equivalent of Bill Gates. That's an obscenity. Nobody should be $96 billion worth of rich, but very well off in the terms assigned to that by the dominant society. Anybody here know a rich Indian? Let me try it another way. Anybody here know of a rich Indian? Yeah, right. Good reason. It's not that there aren't any. There are a few out there. But that just punctuates the point. The point is that according to the federal data, American Indians are the poorest by decisive margin aggregate population in North America, and that's notwithstanding the casino starts over the last 10 years. We're not talking, well, maybe we hadn't ought to go out for Sunday dinner this week, kind of poor, honey. We're not talking you can't buy a new color TV or pickup truck when you prefer to, kind of poor. We're talking a per capita income in western South Dakota and Shannon County of the Pine Ridge Reservation of a little over $2,000 per year. We're talking 90th percentile unemployment every year for the last 50 years. We're talking Shannon County being the poorest county in the entire United States, 50 of those 50 years. I could keep running that down, but there's a translation that comes with the level of poverty we're talking about, 60th percentile unemployment for the country, on reservation and off. But the correlations that come out of it are an infant mortality rate 14.5% times the national average. Death by exposure, something like 5 times the national average. Death by malnutrition at about the same rate. Death by readily curable communicable disease. Death by plague disease. I could keep on listing off the deaths by, but there's a bottom line to that, too. It's a life expectancy for reservation-based American Indian males at the turn of this century, not the last century, when it was that way for the general population, of about 45 years. That's in a country where the general population male life expectancy is 71.8. American Indian women on reservations live about, on average, 3 years longer than men. Sounds like women are doing better than men until you compare American Indian female longevity to that of their general population counterparts, which is 8 years longer than men. So you see proportionately the women are even worse off than the men. What you end up with is every time an American Indian dies on a reservation right now, not 100 years ago, not 150 years ago, right now, one-third of a lifetime as compared to the GPOP has just been lost. Or, since it's not a new situation, flip it over. Every time an American Indian child is born on a reservation, one-third of a lifetime is being lost because it shows no signs of changing within the next few years. That's 30th percentile attrition, a population group on a policy-driven basis. And a policy-driven 30th percentile attrition of any population is genocidal by any standard of measure you want to apply. So much for those two. The third criteria doesn't involve targeting the population itself at all. It has to do with targeting other things upon which they're dependent to sustain themselves as a group and being, creating conditions, as it said, leading to the destruction of the group. Let's say you have a land-based people. Remove the land. Destroy the land, say. Example of that has been talked about earlier today, but I'll mention it again. It's one of the more prominent, of about 50 different examples that I could give you. Okay, the Big Mountain. The largest remaining, as of 1974, enclave of traditionally self-sufficient indigenous people in the United States, and so far as I know, in the continent, because I don't know of that large an aggregate in Canada. The Big Mountain Dene, forcibly removed from their land and dispersed from cities from Los Angeles to Boston in order to make way for expanded mining operations by the Peabody Coal Corporation. Okay, note I said expanded. They were already mining there. They wanted the 44 billion tons of low-sulfur coal that underlay this sheep graze. So these people were utterly disassembled as a sociocultural entity, scattered to the winds so they could not possibly retain social cohesion for the socially all-important purpose that that coal be dug out of the ground and slurried in a pipeline across to the Four Corners power plant and down to the newly constructed Navajo power plant and other power plants so that it could be burned, so that it could turn steam turbines, generate electricity that could be pumped out across power grids and lines running right over the tops of these hogans where these grandmothers, the sheep herders, had lived, didn't even have electricity in the hogan, and just deposited at really important places like Las Vegas to the socially imperative purpose of keeping neon lights lit outside blackjack casinos 24 hours a day so that people could turn it into a kiddie park and go down and do big surf wave rides with their children as recreation. So that air conditioners in the Phoenix Valley could be running 24 hours a day, creating an artificial environment for a bunch of retirees who moved over to an area that is about as alien to Tennessee as it possibly could be, when really they wanted to be in Tennessee in the first place, and they've gone about recreating that environment in an artificial enclave that they've created called Sun Valley. Yeah. Really important stuff. Entire way of life, entire people sacrificed to ends like these. Some of the apologists have actually argued to me that, well, when the mining's done, they could always go back, couldn't they? Anybody ever see what a coal stripping operation does to the land? And this is arid terrain. When they're done, the land itself has been gone. There's no land to go back to. There's no way they can reconstitute themselves within their geographically signifying parameters. Okay, the prime symbols of their culture are the geographic symbols of the Big Mountain area. Those will be destroyed. There is nothing to go back to. This is a permanent, irrevocable genocidal process that is being consummated right now as I speak. Well, that takes care of creating conditions leading to the destruction of the group. You don't have to look too far in history to find it. Maybe you need to be looking forward to who the next victims are going to be that will pass unnoticed into what Trotsky called the dustbin of history, to really important things like we're talking about here. This famous and fabled yuppie, but it's not just yuppies, quality of life that everyone here thinks they're entitled to. By here, I don't mean in this room per se. By here, I mean within this cultural construction. The next one goes to that preventing burst within the group. This is number four. Now, like I said, you could get onto compulsory abortion. I don't know that that's occurred in North America. I don't know that it has a particular relevance to Native people, to anybody else. It may in China, but I'm not talking about China tonight. I'm talking about the United States. And I don't care that somebody else is doing it in terms of it being some sort of a justification or excuse or a mitigation to the fact that the United States does. What I will say is that of 1975, the federal government of the United States effectively conceded that it had run a quiet operation through the Indian Health Service, performing involuntary and in many cases unwitting sterilizations on American Indian women who had come in to be treated for other things. Up to 40% of all the women of childbearing age had been sterilized in such fashion. Now, I said involuntary, and that's the trigger thing, but when I talk about unwitting, you got a double damage. Not only did the sterilization occur, but you basically impose a second layer of psychological damage on top of the first physical damage that was done. I had occasion working at the University of Colorado as a counselor to try to provide referrals and such to women who had been sterilized, didn't know it, were losing their marriages, losing their minds in the process of trying to figure out what was wrong with them. The actuality was nothing was wrong with them. Something was awfully wrong with the health service delivery system that had imposed this upon them. But in any event, that was a clear and clinical case of a contravention of the Genocide Convention that was done as a matter of federal policy in the United States. Almost no one knows about it, despite the fact that it was conceded, and the United States actually took an official action to address the situation when it came out. And the nature of the action taken was that they removed the Indian Health Service from the Bureau of Indian Affairs and put it over into the Department of Health and Human Services. That was it. There was no one indicted, taken to trial. There were no prison sentences served. No one went to the gallows like the Nazis at the Nuremberg trial. No one was fired. So far as I know, no one received a reprimand. The people who had run the project were actually promoted once they got over to DHEW, but this is a clinical example. Maybe that's not the correct word, because I'm not sure these things really qualified as clinics. But it's a categorical illustration, let's put it that way, of the U.S. government's response to the disclosure that it, as a matter of policy, has been committing genocide. That's it. A bureaucratic adjustment and go forward. And don't talk about it. Don't talk about it. You'll get bad wrapped in the local newspaper if you do. Because it's not important and people won't know about it. Substantial stuff that it is. And then the last one. Number five, which has to do with the forced transfer of children from the targeted group to the targeting group, based on a Nazi policy of determining which children in occupied territories belonging to the populations of the occupied territories met certain racial criteria to be considered Aryans. They would be removed from their families and sent to Germany to be raised by barren couples as good Germans. In the case of Luxembourg, which is a predominating policy, it was happening to such an extent that Lemkin actually looked at that and said if they continue to do this, the entire coming generation of Luxembourg is apt to be raised as Germans, not knowing they're Luxembourger. There will be no coming generation of Luxembourg, and Luxembourgish society is going to fall apart. It's going to be just phased out of existence. So it's sort of a non-medical corollary to the sterilization argument. You can accomplish that in other ways. But if you systematically remove the children from a group whose dissolution you're attempting to achieve, to raise them to understand themselves as being someone other than who it was they were born to be, it's a genocidal policy. Here, between 1880 and 1980, the federal government of the United States, with the collaboration of the major churches and many of the states of the Union, administered to what it was called a boarding school program, targeted specifically on American Indian children. North of the border, they had the same thing. They called it residential schools. The object of these institutions was defined by the first overall superintendent, a Captain Richard Henry Pratt, whose qualification for the job was having run the Fort Marion military prison to which they sent Geronimo, the recalcitrant dog soldiers, and other resistors of the 19th century to break them down to what would now be called psychological jelly. That was his specialty. That was his expertise. That's dealing with adult fighters. He's now been unleashed on children. The object, as stated in the enabling legislation, was that they wanted every American Indian child between the ages of 5 and 15, for purposes, as Captain Pratt put it, to kill the Indian in every single pupil, thereby saving the man. By man, he meant human being. Note an interesting distinction. Here's human beings, here's Indians. To be Indian is not to be human. To be human, you have to be de-Indianized. So they're to be deculturated systematically in terms of their Indianness, their identity, their sense of who they are, and reculturated as something they can never be given the racist nature of the society into which they're be assimilated, digested, absorbed. The stated objective of the overall policy is that there be no Indians remaining in the United States, culturally recognizable as such by about 1935. Now, there's nothing that could have come out of the Reich Ministry of Race and Propaganda, Race and Resettlement, excuse me, which could have been any clearer in its intent than that. They don't talk about it much. You don't hear about it in American history, not the Leave It to Beaver history that gets taught in terms of responsible scholarship here. No, the reality will be left out. They never managed to get all of the kids. It wasn't for lack of trying. And it was absolutely coercive. If people would turn their children over, they would accept them. But if people wouldn't turn their children over, they'd go get them. If they went to get them and there was resistance, they'd use all due force. They would come to take the kids. And in five successive generations, they got 50% and upwards. And those kids were taken and run through a military regime. When they got there, they were dosed with DDT. They were scrubbed with brushes because they were told they were dirty because they were dark. Their clothes were taken away. Their hair was cut. They were forbidden to speak their languages. They were forbidden to practice their religion, assuming they knew what it was by the time they arrived at 5 years of age. In a likelihood that they did not, they would be prevented from learning it. Speaking the language, practicing the religion, doing anything outwardly Indian was subject to corporal punishment. And I'm not talking about a little strapping in the principal's office either. I'm talking about getting chained to the wall and chained to posts and solitary confinement for up to 30 days at a time on bread and water. I'm talking about kids being forced to eat their own vomit and having needles run through their tongues, and this horror show can go on for a long time. Break them down as Indians, absolutely traumatize them, terrify them away from their own identity, and re-culturate them is the term that's used in Western mores by Christianizing them. Now, they're going to be academically prepared to accept menial positions in the wage labor economy for which they're being prepared, which means they got to have some instruction in reading, writing, and arithmetic. But to the 4 hours a day that were devoted to academic instruction, two-thirds went to Christian catechism and such things as that. Depends on which particular church denomination was assigned which particular school. But it was Christianization straight down the line. And the linchpin of that was to teach them the work ethic because they were to be workers. But there's a better hook than that that's involved. Part of teaching them the work ethic, having indoctrinated them with it, is to give them experience at it, which is why the boarding schools, both below and above the border, were usually referred to as industrial schools. In the afternoons, when you were done with your schoolwork in the morning, you got to go to work in the factory. And the proceeds of the labor, the production, the profit that was generated went to subsidize a school, which was to break you down and turn you into something you weren't. Or, in a couple of cases that I could name, they were agricultural schools, which meant you went and you baled hay. You did the stoop labor of chopping the corn out of the beans and that sort of thing for free. Again, the profit goes into subsidizing the school, paying the staff salaries of the people who are essentially your torturers, okay? And you could look at this as a sort of prototype for how they're running the U.S. penal system today, and you would not be far off because this was a penologist. This was a specialist in a military prison establishment who was running the show and designed it in the first place. The trauma that was induced didn't go away when they came out of the schools. Now, you had a lot of kids that died there. Somebody ought to make it a standard requirement of people doing American history that they take a trip, a field trip to the Carlisle Indian School and look at the graveyard that is next to it and all those rows of little white crosses, knowing that there's people on average 12 years of age in all of them. They died from the beneficent, civilizing regime that was imposed upon them. The ones that ran away trying to get home and died en route. But the fact of the matter is, even those who survived and came out were utterly traumatized and rendered dysfunctional in psycho-intellectual terms. As I say, they'd been prepared only to despise that which they were, and they could not be that which they were supposedly equipped to become. They're people who are trapped in a limbo land, no place to go. But they got to try to live. And what do? When you try to live? You try to reconstitute something resembling a normal human life. Well, maybe you get married and you try to have a family. Maybe there's going to be some stability in that. As a traumatized individual, as a survivor of a Holocaustal institution, as something that was directed to you for the moment you were old enough to be cognate, the damage is such that you're going to act out the trauma in the context of the relationship, and you're going to transmit it to your children. And it's going to be an intergenerational thing. So the fact that they phased out these institutions as of 1980, figuring that they had done their work, didn't mean the carnage stopped. The carnage exists in every reservation, every urban Indian community I could name. Correlates rather well when you think about it, that half of all those generations of kids were being run through the boarding schools, and about half of all American Indian adults running around today are alcoholics, substance abusers, people who fall into this self-destructive mode of trying to block out this absolutely impossible reality that's been imposed on them. Take the trauma, combine it with the abysmal material circumstances I've talked about, you get the result that I was talking about in the 30th percentile attrition. It's a self-destructive cycle that can never be broken so long as it's maintained in a condition of silence, so long as it's denied, so long as the perpetrator group trivializes it, turns it into a joke, benefits from it, announces its entitlement to the benefits, and asks the perennial question of what's wrong with the Indians? What's wrong with the Indians? How can we help you? Where would I like to end up with that? Two places. One general, one particular to the community. The general one is this. You have to understand everybody and take this one in and grapple with it, deal with it, reach your own conclusion of the significance of what is said. Any people subjected to genocide has not only the right but the obligation to do whatever is necessary and within its power to end the process of genocide. Not simply the right but the obligation. Reaching out and talking and exposing and raising consciousness and all the rest of it only counts for so long. And it only counts in a context where the information is taken seriously and put to practical use in ways that materially change the circumstances. When the information is treated as entertainment or ignored, you've got to avail yourself of other options. The key is effectuality, and in last instance, you will do things that will probably get you criticized in the local newspaper as a result. Okay? But stop real short and ask if you know of another genocidal system, another genocidal society in recent memory that you heard about in history books, and what it was to bring that particular regime into a situation where it could no longer perpetrate the genocide that it had been engaged in. And ask yourself why the rules with regard to this perpetrator society would be so fundamentally different than those imposed upon that one to bring about a halt. Now, I pose those as questions that I would like you, each of you, to go off and arrive at your own answer. Why it is that America would be operating in a completely different set of rules. Immunity and exemption from the consequences of its conduct, not simply at the contemporary moment, but throughout its history. Why would that be? And I think you'll probably arrive at the same conclusion I did, but maybe not. There is absolutely nothing reasonable or rational that would accept America. America is subject to the same rules as everyone else. The other is, please don't, after this is over, repeat the performance at the lecture, or not the lecture, excuse me, the rally earlier today. Because this is part and parcel of the mentality that makes the genocidal process tick. Please do not any of you come up and say, you know, I agreed with most of what you said. And after I fall to my knees, presumably, in thankfulness that somebody agreed with me, proceed in the same tone of voice to tell me how I should have said it different. We will speak for ourselves. We do not need to be corrected. We do not need to receive instruction on how to reach the Eichmanns of the world and bring them over to our side. My response to that is the response that I'll leave you with tonight. I am perfectly clear to anyone capable of understanding the information and dealing with it in an honest fashion. and dishonesty is not something I really have time for, and that is something the opposition movement in the United States, just as well as the status quo in the United States, has to understand. You do not tell those who are the victims of U.S. aggression how it is they should explain the results of that aggression to the perpetrators of it. Thank you very much.